This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West by Blaine Hardin. This book is read by Blaine Hardin. For North Koreans who remain in the camps. There is no human rights issue in this country, as everyone leads the most dignified and happy life. North Korean Central News Agency, March 6, 2009. Preface: A Teachable Moment. His first memory is an execution. He walked with his mother to a wheat field near the Tadong River, where guards had rounded up several thousand prisoners. Excited by the crowd, the boy crawled between adult legs to the front row, where he saw guards tying a man to a wooden pole. Shin In-goon was 4 years old, too young to understand the speech that came before that killing. At dozens of executions in years to come, he would listen to a supervising guard telling the crowd that the prisoner about to die had been offered redemption through hard labor, but had rejected the generosity of the North Korean government. To prevent the prisoner from cursing the state that was about to take his life, guards stuffed pebbles into his mouth, then covered his head with a hood. At that first execution, Shin watched three guards take aim. Each fired three times. The reports of their rifles terrified the boy, and he fell over backward. But he scrambled to his feet in time to see guards untie a slack, blood-spattered body, wrap it in a blanket, and heave it into a cart. In Camp 14, a prison for the political enemies of North Korea, assemblies of more than two inmates were forbidden, except for executions. Everyone had to attend them. The labor camp used a public killing, and the fear it generated, as a teachable moment. Shin's guards in the camp were his teachers and his breeders. They had selected his mother and father. They taught him that prisoners who break camp rules deserve death. On a hillside near his school, a slogan was posted, "All according to the rules and regulations." The boy memorized the camp's 10 rules, the 10 commandments, as he later called them, and can still recite them by heart. The first one stated, "Anyone caught escaping will be shot immediately." 10 years after that first execution, Shin returned to the same field. Again, guards had rounded up a big crowd. Again, a wooden pole had been pounded in the ground. A makeshift gallows had also been built. Shin arrived this time in the back seat of a car driven by a guard. He wore handcuffs and a blindfold fashioned from a rag. His father, also handcuffed and blindfolded, sat beside him in the car. They had been released from 8 months in an underground prison inside Camp 14. As a condition of their release, they had signed documents promising never to discuss what had happened to them underground. In that prison within a prison, guards tried to torture a confession out of Shin and his father. They wanted to know about the failed escape of Shin's mother and only brother. Guards stripped Shin, tied ropes to his ankles and wrists, and suspended him from a hook in the ceiling. They lowered him over a fire. He passed out when his flesh began to burn. But he confessed nothing. He had nothing to confess. He had not conspired with his mother and brother to escape. He believed what guards had taught him since his birth inside the camp. He could never escape, and he must inform on anyone who talks about trying. Not even in his dreams had Shin fantasized about life on the outside. Guards never taught him what every North Korean schoolboy learns. Americans are bastards, scheming to invade and humiliate the homeland. South Korea is the bitch of its American master. North Korea is a great country whose brave and brilliant leaders are the envy of the world. Indeed, he knew nothing of the existence of South Korea, China, or the United States. Unlike his countrymen, he did not grow up with the ubiquitous photograph of his dear leader, as Kim Jong-il was called. Nor had he seen photographs or statues of Kim's father, Kim Il-sung, the great leader who founded North Korea and who remains the country's eternal president, despite his death in 1994. Although he had not been important enough for brainwashing, Shin had been schooled to inform on his family and on his classmates. He won food as a reward and joined guards in beating up children he betrayed. His classmates, in turn, tattled on him and beat him up. When a guard removed his blindfold, when he saw the crowd, the wooden pole, and the gallows, Shin believed he was about to be executed. No pebbles, though, were forced into his mouth. His handcuffs were removed. A guard led him to the front of the crowd. He and his father would be spectators. Guards dragged a middle-aged woman to the gallows and tied a young man to the wooden pole. They were Shin's mother and his older brother. A guard tightened a noose around his mother's neck. She tried to catch his eye. He looked away. After she stopped twitching at the end of the rope, Shin's brother was shot by three guards, each fired three times. As he watched them die, Shin was relieved it was not him. He was angry with his mother and brother for planning an escape. Although he would not admit it to anyone for 15 years, he knew he was responsible for their executions. Introduction. Never heard the word love. 9 years after his mother's hanging, Shin squirmed through an electric fence and ran off through the snow. It was January 2, 2005. Before then, no one born in a North Korean political prison camp had ever escaped. As far as can be determined, Shin is still the only one to do it. He was 23 years old and knew no one outside the fence. Within a month, he had walked into China. Within 2 years, he was living in South Korea. 4 years later, he was living in Southern California and was a senior ambassador at Liberty in North Korea, LINK, an American human rights group. In California, he rode his bike to work, followed the Cleveland Indians because of their South Korean slugger, Shin Soo Chu, and ate two or three times a week at In-N-Out Burger, which he viewed as the world's finest burger. His name is now Shin Dong-hyuk. He changed it after arriving in South Korea, an attempt to reinvent himself as a free man. He is handsome, with quick, wary eyes. A Los Angeles dentist has done work on his teeth, which he could not brush in the camp. His overall physical health is excellent. His body, though, is a roadmap of the hardships of growing up in a labor camp that the North Korean government insists does not exist. Stunted by malnutrition, he is short and slight, 5 feet 6 inches, about 120 pounds. His arms are bowed from childhood labor. His lower back and buttocks are scarred with burns from the torturer's fire. The skin over his pubis bears a puncture scar from the hook used to hold him in place over the fire. His ankles are scarred by shackles from which he was hung upside down in solitary confinement. His right middle finger is cut off at the first knuckle, a guard's punishment for dropping a sewing machine in a camp garment factory. His shins, from ankle to knee on both legs, are mutilated and scarred by burns from the electrified barbed wire fence that failed to keep him inside Camp 14. Shin is roughly the same age as Kim Jong-un, the chubby third son of Kim Jong-il, who took over as leader after his father's death in 2011. As contemporaries, Shin and Kim Jong-un personify the antipodes of privilege and privation in North Korea, a nominally classless society where, in fact, breeding and bloodlines decide everything. Kim Jong-un was born a communist prince and raised behind palace walls. He was educated under an assumed name in Switzerland and returned to North Korea to study in an elite university named after his grandfather. Because of his parentage, he lives above the law. For him, everything is possible. In 2010, he was named a 4-star general in the Korean People's Army, despite a total lack of field experience in the military. A year later, after his father died of a sudden heart attack, state media in North Korea described him as another leader sent from heaven. He may, however, be forced to share his earthly dictatorship with relatives and military leaders. Shin was born a slave and raised behind a high-voltage barbed wire fence. He was educated in a camp school to read and count at a rudimentary level. Because his blood was tainted by the perceived crimes of his father's brothers, he lived below the law. For him, nothing was possible. His state-prescribed career trajectory was hard labor and an early death from disease brought on by chronic hunger, all without a charge or a trial or an appeal, and all in secrecy. In stories of concentration camp survival, there is a conventional narrative arc. Security forces steal the protagonist away from a loving family and a comfortable home. To survive, he abandons moral principles, suppresses feelings for others, and ceases to be a civilized human being. In perhaps the most celebrated of these stories, Night, by Nobel Prize winner Elie Wiesel, the 13-year-old narrator explains his torment with an account of the normal life that existed before he and his family were packed aboard trains bound for Nazi death camps. Wiesel studied the Talmud daily. His father owned a store and watched over their village in Romania. His grandfather was always present to celebrate the Jewish holidays. But after the boy's entire family perished in the camps, Wiesel was left alone, terribly alone, in a world without God, without man, without love or mercy. Shin's story of survival is different. His mother beat him, and he viewed her as a competitor for food. His father, who was allowed by guards to sleep with his mother just 5 nights a year, ignored him. His brother was a stranger. Children in the camp were untrustworthy and abusive. Before he learned anything else, Shin learned to survive by snitching on all of them. Love and mercy and family were words without meaning. God did not disappear or die. Shin had never heard of him. In a preface to Night, Wiesel wrote that an adolescent's knowledge of death and evil should be limited to what one discovers in literature. In Camp 14, Shin did not know literature existed. He saw only one book in the camp, a Korean grammar, in the hands of a teacher who wore a guard's uniform, carried a revolver on his hip, and beat one of his primary school classmates to death with a chalkboard pointer. Unlike those who have survived a concentration camp, Shin had not been torn away from a civilized existence and forced to descend into hell. He was born and raised there. He accepted its values. He called it home. North Korea's labor camps have now existed twice as long as the Soviet Gulag and about 12 times longer than the Nazi concentration camps. There is no dispute about where these camps are. High-resolution satellite photographs, accessible on Google Earth to anyone with an internet connection, show vast, fenced compounds sprawling through the rugged mountains of North Korea. The South Korean government estimates there are about 154,000 prisoners in the camps, while the U.S. State Department and several human rights groups have put the number as high as 200,000. After examining a decade of satellite images of the camps, Amnesty International noticed new construction inside the camps in 2011 and became concerned that the inmate population was increasing, perhaps to short-circuit possible unrest as power began to shift from Kim Jong-il to his young and untried son. There are 6 camps, according to South Korea's intelligence agency and human rights groups. The biggest is 31 miles long and 25 miles wide, an area larger than the city of Los Angeles. Electrified barbed wire fences, punctuated by guard towers and patrolled by armed men, encircle most of the camps. 2 of them, numbers 15 and 18, have re-education zones where some fortunate detainees receive remedial instruction in the teachings of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. If prisoners memorize enough of these teachings and convince guards they are loyal, they can be released, but they are monitored for the rest of their lives by state security. The remaining camps are complete control districts, where prisoners who are called irredeemables are worked to death. Shin's camp, number 14, is a complete control district. By reputation, it is the toughest of them all, because of its particularly brutal working conditions, the vigilance of its guards, and the state's unforgiving view of the seriousness of the crimes committed by its inmates, many of whom are purged officials from the ruling party, the government, and the military, along with their families. Established in 1959 in central North Korea, Ketchon, South Pyongan Province, Camp 14 holds an estimated 15,000 prisoners. About 30 miles long and 15 miles wide, it has farms, mines, and factories threaded through steep mountain valleys. Although Shin is the only one born in a labor camp to escape to tell his story, there are at least 26 other eyewitnesses from the labor camps now in the free world. They include at least 15 North Koreans who were imprisoned in Camp 15's Edification District, won their release, and later turned up in South Korea. Former guards from other camps have also found their way to South Korea. Kim Young, a former North Korean lieutenant colonel from a privileged background in Pyongyang, spent 6 years in two camps before escaping in a coal train. A distillation of their testimony by the Korean Bar Association in Seoul paints a detailed picture of daily life in the camps. A few prisoners are publicly executed every year. Others are beaten to death or secretly murdered by guards, who have almost complete license to abuse and rape prisoners. Most prisoners tend crops, mine coal, sew military uniforms, or make cement while subsisting on a near-starvation diet of corn, cabbage, and salt. They lose their teeth, their gums turn black, their bones weaken, and as they enter their 40s, they hunch over at the waist. Issued a set of clothes once or twice a year, they commonly work and sleep in filthy rags, living without soap, socks, gloves, underclothes, or toilet paper. 12 to 15-hour workdays are mandatory until prisoners die, usually of malnutrition-related illnesses, before they turn 50. Although precise numbers are impossible to obtain, Western governments and human rights groups estimate that hundreds of thousands of people have perished in these camps. Most North Koreans are sent to the camps without any judicial process, and many die there without learning the charges against them. They are taken from their homes, usually at night, by the Buibu, the National Security Agency. Guilt by association is legal in North Korea. A wrongdoer is often imprisoned with his parents and children. Kim Il-sung laid down the law in 1972. Enemies of class, whoever they are, their seed must be eliminated through 3 generations. My first encounter with Shin was at lunch in the winter of 2008. We met in a Korean restaurant in downtown Seoul. Talkative and hungry, he wolfed down several helpings of rice and beef. As he ate, he told my translator and me what it was like to watch as his mother was hanged. He blamed her for his torture in the camp, and he went out of his way to say that he was still furious with her. He said he had not been a good son, but would not explain why. During his years in the camp, he said he had never once heard the word love, certainly not from his mother, a woman he continued to despise even in death. He had heard about the concept of forgiveness in a South Korean church, but it confused him. To ask for forgiveness in Camp 14, he said, was to beg not to be punished. He had written a memoir about the camp, but it had received little attention in South Korea. He was jobless, broke, behind on his rent, and uncertain what to do next. The rules of Camp 14 had prevented him, on pain of execution, from having intimate contact with a woman. He now wanted to find a proper girlfriend, but said he didn't know how to begin looking for one. After lunch, he took me to the small, sad apartment in Seoul that he could not afford. Although he would not look me in the eye, he showed me his chopped-off finger and his scarred back. He allowed me to take his photograph. For all the hardship he had endured, he had a baby face. He was 26 years old, 3 years out of Camp 14. I was 56 years old at that memorable lunch. As a correspondent for the Washington Post in Northeast Asia, I had been searching for more than a year for a story that could explain how North Korea used repression to keep from falling apart. Political implosion had become my specialty. For the Post and for the New York Times, I had spent nearly 3 decades covering failed states in Africa, the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, the breakup of Yugoslavia, and the slow-motion rot in Burma under the generals. From the outside looking in, North Korea seemed ripe, indeed overripe, for the kind of collapse I had witnessed elsewhere. In a part of the world where nearly everyone else was getting rich, its people were increasingly isolated, poor, and hungry. Still, the Kim family dynasty kept the lid on. Totalitarian repression preserved their basket case state. My problem in showing how the government did it was lack of access. Elsewhere in the world, repressive states were not always successful in sealing their borders. I had been able to work openly in Mengistu's Ethiopia, Mobutu's Congo, and Milosevic's Serbia, and had slipped in as a tourist to write about Burma. North Korea was much more careful. Foreign reporters, especially Americans, were rarely allowed inside. I visited North Korea only once and saw what my minders wanted me to see and learned little. If journalists entered illegally, they risked months or years of imprisonment as spies. To win release, they sometimes needed the help of a former American president. Given these restrictions, most reporting about North Korea was distant and hollow. Written from Seoul or Tokyo or Beijing, stories began with an account of Pyongyang's latest provocation, such as sinking a ship or shooting a tourist. Then the dreary conventions of journalism kicked in. American and South Korean officials expressed outrage. Chinese officials called for restraint. Think tank experts opined about what it might mean. I wrote more than my share of these pieces. Shin, though, shattered these conventions. His life unlocked the door, allowing outsiders to see how the Kim family sustained itself with child slavery and murder. A few days after we met, Shin's appealing picture and appalling story ran prominently on the front page of the Washington Post. "Wow," wrote Donald G. Graham, chairman of the Washington Post Company, in a one-word email I received the morning after the story appeared. A German filmmaker, who happened to be visiting Washington's Holocaust Memorial Museum on the day the story was published, decided to make a documentary about Shin's life. The Washington Post ran an editorial saying that the brutality Shin endured was horrifying, but just as horrifying was the world's indifference to the existence of North Korea's labor camps. The editorial concluded, "High school students in America debate why President Franklin D. Roosevelt didn't bomb the rail lines to Hitler's camps." Their children may ask, a generation from now, why the West stared at far clearer satellite images of Kim Jong-il's camps and did nothing. Shin's story seemed to get under the skin of ordinary readers. They wrote letters and sent emails offering money, housing, and prayers. A married couple in Columbus, Ohio, saw the article, located Shin, and paid him to travel to the United States. Lowell and Linda Dai told Shin they wanted to be the parents he never had. A young Korean-American woman in Seattle, Harim Lee, read the story and prayed that she would meet Shin. She later sought him out in Southern California, and they fell in love. My article had only skimmed the surface of Shin's life. It struck me that a deeper account would unveil the secret machinery that enforces totalitarian rule in North Korea. It would also show, through the details of Shin's improbable flight, how some of that oppressive machinery is breaking down, allowing an unworldly young escapee to wander undetected across a police state and cross into China. As important, no one who read a book about a boy bred by North Korea to be worked to death could ever ignore the existence of the camps. I asked Shin if he was interested. It took him 9 months to make up his mind. During those months, human rights activists in South Korea, Japan, and the United States urged him to cooperate, telling him that a book in English would raise world awareness, increase international pressure on North Korea, and perhaps put some much-needed money in his pocket. After Shin said yes, he made himself available for 7 rounds of interviews, first in Seoul, then in Torrance, California, and finally in Seattle, Washington. Shin and I agreed to a 50-50 split of whatever it might earn. Our agreement, though, gave me control over the contents. Shin began keeping a diary in early 2006, about a year after his escape from North Korea. In Seoul, after he was hospitalized for depression, he continued writing in it. The diary became the basis for his Korean language memoir, Escape to the Outside World, which was published in Seoul in 2007 by the Database Center for North Korean Human Rights. The memoir was a starting point for our interviews. It was also the source for many of the direct quotations that are attributed in this book to Shin, his family, friends, and prison keepers during the time he was in North Korea and China. But every thought and action attributed to Shin in these pages is based on multiple interviews with him, during which he expanded upon and in many crucial instances corrected his Korean memoir. Even as he cooperated, Shin seemed to dread talking to me. I often felt like a dentist, drilling without anesthetics. The drilling went on intermittently for more than 2 years. Some of our sessions were cathartic for him. Many others made him depressed. He struggled to trust me. As he readily admits, he struggles to trust anyone. It is an inescapable part of how he was raised. Guards taught him to sell out his parents and friends, and he assumes everyone he meets will sell him out in turn. In writing this book, I have sometimes struggled to trust him. He misled me in our first interview about his role in the death of his mother, and he continued to do so in more than a dozen interviews. When he changed his story, I became worried about what else he might have made up. Fact-checking is not possible in North Korea. Outsiders have not visited its political prison camps. Accounts of what goes on inside them cannot be independently verified. Although satellite images have greatly added to outside understanding of the camps, defectors remain the primary sources of information, and their motives and credibility are not spotless. In South Korea and elsewhere, they are often desperate to make a living, willing to confirm the preconceptions of human rights activists, anti-communist missionaries, and right-wing ideologues. Some camp survivors refuse to talk unless they are paid cash up front. Others repeated juicy anecdotes they had heard but not personally witnessed. While Shin remained wary of me, he responded to every question about his past that I could think of. His life can seem incredible, but it echoes the experiences of other former prisoners in the camps, as well as the accounts of former camp guards. "Everything Shin has said is consistent with what I have heard about the camps," said David Hawk, a human rights specialist who has interviewed Shin and more than 24 other former labor camp prisoners for The Hidden Gulag, Exposing North Korea's Prison Camps, a report that links survivors' accounts with annotated satellite images. It was first published in 2003 by the U.S. Committee for Human Rights in North Korea and has been updated as more testimony and higher-resolution satellite images became available. Hawk told me that because Shin was born and raised in a camp, he knows things that other camp survivors do not. Shin's story has also been vetted by the authors of the Korean Bar Association's White Paper on Human Rights in North Korea, 2008. They conducted extensive interviews with Shin, as well as with other known camp survivors willing to talk. As Hawk has written, the only way for North Korea to refute, contradict, or invalidate the testimony of Shin and other camp survivors would be to permit outside experts to visit the camps. Otherwise, Hawk declares, their testimony stands. If North Korea does collapse, Shin may be correct in predicting that its leaders, fearing war crimes trials, will demolish the camps before investigators can get to them. As Kim Jong-il explained, "We must envelop our environment in a dense fog to prevent our enemies from learning anything about us." To try to piece together what I could not see, I spent the better part of 3 years reporting about North Korea's military, leadership, economy, food shortages, and human rights abuses. I interviewed scores of North Korean defectors, including 3 former inmates of Camp 15 and a former camp guard and driver who worked at 4 labor camps. I spoke to South Korean scholars and technocrats who travel regularly inside North Korea, and I reviewed the growing body of scholarly research on and personal memoirs about the camps. In the United States, I conducted extended interviews with Korean Americans who have become Shin's closest friends. In assessing Shin's story, one should keep in mind that many others in the camps have endured similar or worse hardships, according to An Myung-chul, a former camp guard and driver. Shin had a relatively comfortable life by the standards of other children in the camps, Ann said. By exploding nuclear bombs, attacking South Korea, and cultivating a reputation for hair-trigger belligerence, the government of North Korea has stirred up a semi-permanent security emergency on the Korean Peninsula. When North Korea deigns to enter into international diplomacy, it has always succeeded in shoving human rights off any negotiating table. Crisis management, usually focused on nuclear weapons and missiles, has dominated American dealings with the North. The labor camps have been an afterthought. Talking to them about the camps is something that has not been possible. David Straub, who worked at the State Department during the Clinton and Bush years as a senior official responsible for North Korean policy, told me, "They go nuts when you talk about it. The camps have barely pricked the world's collective conscience. In the United States, newspaper stories notwithstanding, ignorance of their existence remains widespread. For several years in Washington, a handful of North Korean defectors and camp survivors gathered each spring on the Mall for speeches and marches. The Washington Press Corps paid little attention. Part of the reason was language. Most of the defectors spoke only Korean. As important, in a media culture that feeds on celebrity, no movie star, no pop idol, no Nobel Prize winner stepped forward to demand that outsiders invest emotionally in a distant issue that lacks good video. Suzanne Schulte, a longtime activist who brought camp survivors to Washington, told me that Tibetans have the Dalai Lama and Richard Gere. Burmese have Aung San Suu Kyi. Darfurians have Mia Farrow and George Clooney. North Koreans have no one like that. Shin told me he does not deserve to speak for the tens of thousands still in the camps. He is ashamed of what he did to survive and escape. He has resisted learning English, in part because he does not want to have to tell his story again and again in a language that might make him important. But he desperately wants the world to understand what North Korea has tried so diligently to hide. His burden is a heavy one. No one else born and raised in the camps has escaped to explain what went on inside, what still goes on inside. Chapter 1. The Boy Who Ate His Mother's Lunch. Shin and his mother lived in the best prisoner quarters Camp 14 had to offer, a model village next to an orchard and just across from the field where his mother was later hanged. Each of the 40 one-story buildings in the village housed four families. Shin and his mother had their own room where they slept side by side on a concrete floor. The four families shared a common kitchen, which had a single bare light bulb. Electricity ran 2 hours a day, from 4 to 5 in the morning and 10 to 11 at night. Windows were made of gray vinyl, too opaque to see through. Rooms were heated, in the Korean way, by a coal fire in the kitchen with flues running under the bedroom floor. The camp had its own coal mines, and coal for heating was readily available. There were no beds, chairs, or tables. There was no running water. No bath or shower. Prisoners who wanted to bathe sometimes sneaked down to the river in the summer. About 30 families shared a well for drinking water. They also shared a privy, which was divided in half for men and women. Defecating and urinating there were mandatory, as human waste was used as fertilizer on the camp farm. If Shin's mother met her daily work quota, she could bring home food for that night and the following day. At 4 in the morning, she would prepare breakfast and lunch for her son and for herself. Every meal was the same: corn porridge, pickled cabbage, and cabbage soup. Shin ate this meal nearly every day for 23 years, unless he was denied food as punishment. When he was too young for school, his mother often left him alone in the house in the morning and came back from the fields at midday for lunch. Shin was always hungry, and he would eat his lunch as soon as his mother left for work in the morning. He also ate her lunch. When she came back at midday and found nothing to eat, she would become furious and beat her son with a hoe, a shovel, anything close at hand. Some of the beatings were as violent as those he later received from guards. Still, Shin took as much food as he could from his mother as often as he could. It did not occur to him that if he ate her lunch, she would go hungry. Many years later, after she was dead and he was living in the United States, he would tell me that he loved his mother, but that was in retrospect. That was after he learned that a civilized child should love his mother. When he was in the camp, depending on her for all his meals, stealing her food, enduring her beatings, he saw her as competition for survival. Her name was Jang Hee-kyung. Shin remembers her as short and slightly plump, with powerful arms. She wore her hair cut short, like all women in the camp, and was required to cover her head with a white cloth folded into a triangle that tied around the back of her neck. Shin discovered her birth date, October 1, 1950, from a document he saw during his interrogation in the underground prison. She never talked to him about her past, her family, or why she was in the camp, and he never asked. His existence as her son had been arranged by guards. They chose her and the man who became Shin's father as prizes for each other in a reward marriage. Single men and women slept in dormitories segregated by sex. The 8th rule of Camp 14, as Shin was required to memorize it, said, "Should sexual physical contact occur without prior approval, the perpetrators will be shot immediately." Rules were the same in other North Korean labor camps. If unauthorized sex resulted in a pregnancy or a birth, the woman and her baby were usually killed, according to my interviews with a former camp guard and several former prisoners. They said that women who had sex with guards in an attempt to get more food or easier work knew that the risks were high. If they became pregnant, they disappeared. A reward marriage was the only safe way around the no-sex rule. Marriage was dangled in front of prisoners as the ultimate bonus for hard work and reliable snitching. Men became eligible at 25, women at 23. Guards announced marriages 3 or 4 times a year, usually on propitious dates such as New Year's or Kim Jong-il's birthday. Neither bride nor groom had much say in deciding whom they would marry. If one partner found his or her chosen mate to be unacceptably old, cruel, or ugly, guards would sometimes cancel a marriage. If they did, neither the man nor the woman would be allowed to marry again. Shin's father, Shin Kyung-sub, told Shin that guards gave him Jang as payment for his skill in operating a metal lathe in the camp's machine shop. Shin's mother never told Shin why she had been given the honor of marriage. But for her, as for many brides in the camp, marriage was a kind of promotion. It came with a slightly better job and better housing in the model village, where there was a school and health clinic. Shortly after her marriage, she was transferred there from a crowded dormitory for women in the camp's garment factory. Jang was also given a coveted job on a nearby farm, where there were opportunities to steal corn, rice, and green vegetables. After their marriage, the couple was allowed to sleep together for 5 consecutive nights. From then on, Shin's father, who continued to live in a dormitory at his work site, was permitted to visit Jang a few times a year. Their liaison produced 2 sons. The eldest, Hee Gyun, was born in 1974. Shin was born 8 years later. The brothers barely knew each other. When Shin was born, his older brother was away in primary school for 10 hours a day. By the time Shin was 4, his brother had moved out of the house at the mandatory age of 12 and into a dormitory. As for his father, Shin remembers that he sometimes showed up at night and left early in the morning. He paid little attention to the boy, and Shin grew up indifferent to his presence. In the years after he escaped the camp, Shin learned that many people associate warmth, security, and affection with the words mother, father, and brother. That was not his experience. Guards taught him and other children in the camp that they were prisoners because of the sins of their parents. The children were told that while they should always be ashamed of their traitorous blood, they could go a long way toward washing away their inherent sinfulness by working hard, obeying the guards, and informing on their parents. The 10th rule of Camp 14 said that a prisoner must truly consider each guard as his teacher. That made sense to Shin. As a child and as a teen, his parents were exhausted, distant, and uncommunicative. Shin was a scrawny, incurious, and for the most part friendless child, whose one source of certainty was the guard's lectures about redemption through snitching. His understanding of right and wrong, though, was often muddied by encounters he witnessed between his mother and camp guards. When he was 10, Shin left his house one evening and went looking for his mother. He was hungry, and it was time for her to prepare dinner. He walked to a nearby rice field where his mother worked and asked a woman if she had seen her. "She's cleaning the Boeji Dewan's room," the woman told him, referring to the office of the guard in charge of the rice farm. Shin walked to the guard's office and found the front door locked. He peeked through a window on the side of the building. His mother was on her knees cleaning the floor. As Shin watched, the Boeji Dewan came into view. He approached Shin's mother from behind and began to grope her. She offered no resistance. Both of them removed their clothes. Shin watched them have sex. He never asked his mother about what he saw, and never mentioned it to his father. That same year, students in Shin's class at primary school were required to volunteer to help their parents at work. He joined his mother one morning to plant rice seedlings. She seemed unwell and fell behind in her planting. Shortly before the lunch break, her slack pace caught the eye of a guard. "You bitch," he shouted at her. Bitch was the standard form of address when camp guards spoke to female prisoners. Guards usually called Shin and other male prisoners son of a bitch. "How are you able to stuff your face when you can't even plant rice?" the guard asked. She apologized, but the guard grew increasingly angry. "This bitch won't do," he shouted. As Shin stood beside his mother, the guard invented a punishment for her. "Go kneel on that ridge there and raise your arms. Stay in that position until I come back from lunch." Shin's mother knelt on the ridge in the sun for an hour and a half, arms reaching for the sky. The boy stood nearby and watched. He did not know what to say to her. He said nothing. When the guard returned, he ordered Shin's mother back to work. Weak and hungry, she passed out in the middle of the afternoon. Shin ran to the guard, begging him for help. Other workers dragged his mother to a shaded rest area, where she regained consciousness. That evening, Shin went with his mother to an ideological struggle meeting, a compulsory gathering for self-criticism. Shin's mother again fell to her knees at the meeting, as 40 of her fellow farm workers followed the Boiji Dowan's lead and berated her for failing to fill her work quota. On summer nights, Shin and some of the other small boys in his village would sneak into the orchard just north of the cluster of concrete dwellings where they lived. They picked unripe pears and cucumbers and ate them as quickly as they could. When they were caught, guards would beat them with batons and ban them from lunch at school for several days. Guards, though, did not care if Shin and his friends ate rats, frogs, snakes, and insects. They were intermittently abundant in the sprawling camp, which used few pesticides, relied on human waste as fertilizer, and supplied no water for cleaning privies or taking baths. Eating rats not only filled his stomach, it was essential to survival. Their flesh could help prevent pellagra, a sometimes fatal disease that was rampant in the camp, especially in the winter. Prisoners with pellagra, the result of a lack of protein and niacin in their diets, suffered weakness, skin lesions, diarrhea, and dementia. It was a frequent cause of death. Catching and roasting rats became a passion for Shin. He caught them in his house, in the fields, and in the privy. He would meet his friends in the evening at his primary school, where there was a coal grill to roast them. Shin peeled away their skin, scraped away their innards, salted what was left, and chewed the rest, flesh, bones, and tiny feet. He also learned to use the stems of foxtail grass to spear grasshoppers, long-headed locusts, and dragonflies, which he roasted over a fire in late summer and autumn. In the mountain forests, where groups of students were often sent to gather wood, Shin ate wild grapes, gooseberries, and Korean raspberries by the fistful. During winter, spring, and early summer, there was much less to eat. Hunger drove him and his boyhood friends to try strategies that older prisoners in the camp claimed could ease the discomfort of an empty stomach. They ate meals without water or soup, under the theory that liquid accelerated digestion and quickened the return of hunger pangs. They also tried to refrain from defecating, believing that this would make them feel full and less obsessed with food. An alternative hunger-fighting technique was to imitate cows, regurgitating a recent meal and eating it again. Shin tried this a few times, but it didn't help ease his hunger. Summertime, when children were sent to the fields to help plant and weed, was peak season for rats and field mice. Shin remembers eating them every day. His happiest, most contented childhood moments were when his belly was full. The eating problem, as it's often called in North Korea, is not confined to labor camps. It has stunted the bodies of millions across the country. Teenage boys fleeing the North in the past decade are on average 5 inches shorter and weigh 25 pounds less than boys growing up in South Korea. Mental retardation caused by early childhood malnutrition disqualifies about a quarter of potential military conscripts in North Korea, according to the National Intelligence Council, a research institution that is part of the U.S. intelligence community. Its report said hunger-caused intellectual disabilities among the young were likely to cripple economic growth, even if the country opened to the outside world or united with the South. Since the 1990s, North Korea has been unable to grow, buy, or deliver enough food to feed its population. Famine in the mid-1990s killed perhaps 1 million North Koreans. A similar death rate in the United States would claim about 12 million lives. The North's food disaster eased in the late 1990s as the government agreed to receive international food aid. The United States became North Korea's largest aid donor while remaining its most demonized enemy. Every year, North Korea needs to produce more than 5 million tons of rice and cereal grain to feed its 23 million people. Nearly every year it falls short, usually by about 1 million tons. With long winters and high mountains, the country lacks arable land, denies incentives to farmers, and cannot afford fuel or modern farm equipment. It squeaked by for years without a food catastrophe thanks to subsidies from Moscow. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the subsidies ended, and North Korea's centrally planned economy stopped functioning. There was no free fuel for its aging factories, no guaranteed markets for its often shoddy goods, and no access to cheap, Soviet-made chemical fertilizers on which state farms had become dependent. For several years, South Korea helped fill the gap, giving Pyongyang 500,000 tons of fertilizer annually as part of its sunshine policy to ease North-South tensions. When new leadership in Seoul cut off the free fertilizer in 2008, North Korea tried to do nationally what it has been doing for decades in its labor camps. The masses were told to make toebi, a fertilizer in which ash is mixed with human excrement. In recent winters, frozen human waste has been chipped out of public toilets in cities and towns across the country. Factories, public enterprises, and neighborhoods have been ordered to produce 2 tons of toebi, according to Good Friends, a Buddhist charity with informants in North Korea. In the spring, it was dried in the open air before being transported to state farms. But organic fertilizers have not come close to replacing the chemicals that state farms depended on for decades. Sealed away behind an electrified fence during the 1990s, Shin was unaware that millions of his countrymen were desperately hungry. Neither he nor his parents, as far as Shin knew, heard that the government was struggling to feed the army or that people were dying of starvation in their apartments in North Korean cities, including the capital. They did not know that tens of thousands of North Koreans had abandoned their homes and were walking into China in search of food. Nor were they beneficiaries of the billions of dollars worth of food aid that poured into North Korea. During those chaotic years, as the basic functioning of Kim Jong-il's government stalled, think tank experts in the West were writing books with doomsday titles such as The End of North Korea. The end was nowhere in sight inside Camp 14, which was self-sufficient except for occasional trainloads of salt. Prisoners grew their own corn and cabbage. As slave workers, they produced low-cost vegetables and fruit, farmed fish and pork, and made uniforms, cement, pottery, and glassware for the crumbling economy outside the fence. Shin and his mother were miserable and hungry during the famine, but no more than they were accustomed to. The boy carried on as before, hunting rats, filching his mother's food, and always enduring her beatings. Chapter 2. School Days. The teacher sprang a surprise search. He rifled through Shin's pockets and those of the 40 other 6-year-olds in his class. When it was over, the teacher held 5 kernels of corn. They all belonged to a girl who was short, slight, and, as Shin remembers, exceptionally pretty. He doesn't recall the girl's name, but everything else about that school day in June 1989 stands out in his memory. The teacher was in a bad mood as he began searching pockets. When he found corn, he erupted. "You bitch! You stole corn! You want your hands cut off?" He ordered the girl to the front of the class and told her to kneel. Swinging his long wooden pointer, he struck her on the head again and again. As Shin and his classmates watched in silence, lumps puffed up on her skull. Blood leaked from her nose. She toppled over onto the concrete floor. Shin and several other classmates picked her up and carried her home to a pig farm not far from the school. Later that night, she died. Subsection 3 of Camp 14's third rule said, "Anyone who steals or conceals any foodstuffs will be shot immediately." Shin had learned that teachers usually did not take this rule seriously. If they found food in a student's pocket, they would sometimes deliver a couple of desultory whacks with a stick. More often, they would do nothing. It was common for Shin and other students to take a chance. The pretty little girl was just unlucky, as Shin saw it. He had been trained by guards and teachers to believe that every time he was beaten, he deserved it, because of the treasonous blood he had inherited from his parents. The girl was no different. Shin thought her punishment was just and fair, and he never became angry with his teacher for killing her. He believed his classmates felt the same way. At school the next day, no mention was made of the beating. Nothing changed in the classroom. As far as Shin was aware, the teacher was not disciplined for his actions. Shin spent all 5 years of primary school in class with this same teacher, who was in his early 30s, wore a uniform, and carried a pistol and a holster on his hip. In breaks between classes, he allowed students to play rock, paper, scissors. On Saturdays, he would sometimes grant children an hour or two to pick lice out of each other's hair. Shin never learned his name. In grade school, Shin was taught to stand up straight, bow to his teachers, and never look them in the eye. At the start of school, he was given a black uniform, pants, shirt, an undershirt, and a pair of shoes. They were replaced every 2 years, although they began to fall apart within a month or two. Soap was sometimes distributed to students as a special reward for hard work. Shin did not distinguish himself with diligence and rarely touched soap. His pants were cardboard stiff from dirt and sweat. If he scraped his skin with a fingernail, grime flaked off. When it was too cold to bathe in the river or stand outside in the rain, Shin and his mother and his classmates smelled like farm animals. Nearly everyone's kneecaps turned black in winter from the dirt. Shin's mother sewed underwear and socks for him out of rags. After her death, he wore no underwear and struggled to find rags to wear inside his shoes. School, a cluster of buildings readily viewed on satellite photographs, was about a 7-minute walk from Shin's house. Windows there were made of glass, not vinyl. That was the only frill. Like his mother's house, Shin's classroom was made of concrete. The teacher stood at a podium in front of a single blackboard. Boys and girls sat separately on either side of a middle aisle. Portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, the centerpieces of every classroom in North Korea, were nowhere to be found. Instead, the school taught rudimentary literacy and numeracy, drilled children in camp rules, and constantly reminded them of their iniquitous blood. Primary school students attended class 6 days a week. Secondary students attended 7, with 1 day off a month. "You have to wash away the sins of your mothers and fathers, so work hard," the headmaster told them at assemblies. The school day began promptly at 8 with a session called Changhua. It means total harmony, but it was an occasion for the teacher to criticize students for what they had done wrong the previous day. Attendance was checked twice daily. No matter how sick a student might be, absences were not allowed. Shin occasionally helped his classmates carry an ailing student to school, but he was rarely sick, other than with colds. He was inoculated just once for smallpox. Shin learned how to read and write the Korean alphabet, doing exercises on coarse paper made in the camp from corn husks. Each term, he was given one notebook with 25 pages. For a pencil, he often used a sharpened shaft of charred wood. He did not know of the existence of erasers. There were no reading exercises, as the teacher had the only book. For writing exercises, students were instructed to explain how they had failed to work hard and follow rules. Shin learned to add and subtract, but not to multiply and divide. To this day, when he needs to multiply, he adds a column of numbers. Physical education meant running around outside and playing on iron bars in the schoolyard. Sometimes, students would go down to the river and gather snails for their teacher. There were no ball games. Shin saw a soccer ball for the first time when he was 23, after fleeing to China. The school's long-term goals for students were implicit in what teachers never bothered to teach. They told Shin that North Korea was an independent state and noted the existence of cars and trains. This wasn't much of a revelation, since Shin had seen guards drive cars, and there was a train station in the southwest corner of the camp. The teacher said nothing about North Korea's geography, its neighbors, its history, or its leaders. Shin had only a vague notion of who the great leader and the dear leader were. Questions were not allowed in school. They angered teachers and triggered beatings. Teachers talked, students listened. By repetition in class, Shin mastered the alphabet and basic grammar. He learned how to pronounce words, but frequently had no idea what they meant. His teacher made him afraid, on an instinctive level, of trying to seek out new information. Shin never came in contact with a classmate who had been born outside the camp. As far as he could tell, the school was reserved for children like him, the camp-bred spawn of reward marriages. He was told that children born elsewhere and brought into the camp with their parents were denied schooling and confined to the camp's most remote sections, valleys 4 and 5. His teachers, as a result, could shape the minds and values of students without contradiction from children who might know something about what existed beyond the fence. There was no secret about what was in store for Shin and his classmates. Primary and secondary school trained them for hard labor. In the winter, children cleared snow, chopped down trees, and shoveled coal for heating the school. The entire student body, about 1,000 students, was mobilized to clean privies in the Bowie-Wan village where guards lived, some of them with wives and children. Shin and his classmates went from house to house, chipping out frozen feces with hose and dumping the waste with bare hands, there were no gloves for camp prisoners, on A-frame racks. They dragged the excrement to surrounding fields or carried it on their backs. On warmer, happier days after school ended in the afternoon, Shin's class would sometimes march into the hills and mountains behind the school to collect food and herbs for their guards. Although it was against the rules, they often stuffed bracken, osmunda, and other ferns inside their uniforms and brought them home to their mothers to make side dishes. They picked agaric mushrooms in April and pine mushrooms in October. On these long afternoon walks, children were allowed to talk with each other. Strict segregation between sexes was relaxed, as boys and girls worked, giggled, and played alongside one another. Shin began first grade with two other children from his village, Hong Sung Jo, a boy, and Moon Sung Sim, a girl. They walked to school together for 5 years and sat in the same classroom. In secondary school, they spent another 5 years in one another's company. Shin viewed Hong Sung Jo as his closest companion. They played jacks between classes at school. Their mothers worked at the same farm. Neither boy, though, ever invited the other to his house to play. Trust among friends was poisoned by constant competition for food and pressure to snitch. Trying to win extra food rations, children told teachers and guards what their neighbors were eating, wearing, and saying. Collective punishment at school also turned classmates against each other. Shin's class was often given a daily quota of trees to plant or acorns to gather. If they failed to meet expectations, everyone in his class was penalized. Teachers ordered Shin's class to give up its lunch ration for a day or sometimes a week to another class that had filled its quota. In work details, Shin was usually slow, often last. As Shin and his classmates grew older, their work details, called rallies of endeavor, grew longer and more difficult. During weeding combat, which occurred between June and August, primary school students worked from 4 in the morning until dusk, pulling weeds in corn, bean, and sorghum fields. When Shin and his classmates entered secondary school, they were barely literate. But by then, classroom instruction had come to an end. Teachers became foremen. Secondary school was the staging ground for work details in mines, fields, and forests. At the end of the day, it was a gathering place for long sessions of self-criticism. Shin entered his first coal mine at the age of 10. He and 5 of his classmates, 3 boys and 3 girls, including his neighbor, Moon Sung Sim, walked down a steep shaft to the face of the mine. Their job was to load coal into 2-ton ore cars and push them uphill on a narrow rail track to a staging area. To meet their daily quota, they had to get 4 cars up the hill. The first 2 took all morning. After a lunch of milled corn and salted cabbage, the exhausted children, their faces and clothes covered in coal dust, headed back to the coal face, carrying candles in the ink-black mine. One day, pushing the 3rd car, Moon Sung Sim lost her balance, and one of her feet slipped beneath a steel wheel. Shin, who was standing next to her, heard a scream. He tried to help the writhing, sweating girl remove her shoe. Her big toe was crushed and oozing blood. Another student tied a shoelace around her ankle as a kind of tourniquet. Shin and two other boys lifted Moon into an empty coal car and pushed it to the top of the mine. Then they carried her to the camp hall.